This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, it's good to have you with us on this wonderful day. I'm Joel Hilliker. America's moral standing in the world is shamefully low in many nations' eyes. European countries in particular seem to take delight in criticizing America for its racism, its police brutality, its environmental policies, and other areas. What's ironic, though, is it seems to reserve this sanctimony solely for America. It seems unconcerned about even worse crimes by other nations, including a major nation guilty of egregious lies, theft, and shocking human rights abuses. We'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about what's happening in this other nation. America's presidential election is just 41 days away, and it promises to be an extremely contentious affair. Many people believe it's going to result in riots and violence. This past summer, a group called the Transition Integrity Project met to try to project some crisis scenarios that may result from the election. And in their view, there's only one possible election outcome that won't result in riots. We'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about how Democrats are quietly preparing for post-election violence. The Abraham Accords, the recent peace deals between the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Israel, changed a long-standing rule. For decades, Arabs have said they would never make peace with the Jewish state before the question of Palestinian statehood was resolved. Well, the Palestinians feel abandoned and angered by these deals. In our third segment, we'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Mihailo Zekic about whether this might actually cause these two rival Palestinian factions, Hamas and Fatah, to come together to resolve their differences and force Palestinian statehood. Finally, we will learn an inspiring lesson about how God can fulfill all the desires of your heart. We'll start, though, by talking about this stunning double standard by Europe. And we'll hear about this in this report from Jeremiah Jacques.
To begin, I'd like to read three short statements made this year by European leaders. And I'll omit one word, which is the name of a certain country, from each one, to see if you can fill in the blanks. The first one is from European Union Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. She said, quote, "It is not possible to shape the world of tomorrow without a strong EU-blank relationship." The next is from German Chancellor Angela Merkel. She said, quote, "It is in Europe's utmost interest to work closely with blank on all fronts." And the last one I'll read here is from EU diplomat Nicholas Chappius. He said, "The right path for Europe is to take stock of the innovative policies and formidable economy of blank and to pursue engagement rather than confrontation." End quote. These three statements reflect a view that is becoming increasingly prevalent among the leaders and peoples of Europe. And one may think that this innovative, economically powerful nation that they're talking about, the country that they seek to build a strong relationship with on all fronts, is the United States. That would make sense because the U.S. is the democratic country that has spent hundreds of billions of dollars over the past 75 years to rebuild and safeguard Europe and to stabilize the world. But the country in the blanks is not the United States. It's the communist regime of the People's Republic of China. In recent years, Europe and China have dramatically boosted their trade. China is now the EU's second biggest trade partner, and the EU is China's biggest. The two have also expanded cooperation in the realms of politics, technology, education, environment, energy, culture, science, and even military. And a growing number of European policymakers are determined to do whatever it takes to continue shaping the world of tomorrow by engaging with China. Even if it means compromising democratic values, and even if it means remaining mostly silent about the communist regime's abuse of human rights. And that remains true even as China's violation of individual rights becomes increasingly obvious and increasingly cruel. The location where China's cruelty is on most glaring display is Xinjiang, in the northwest part of China. This region was long disputed by the Mongols, Chinese, and various Turkic peoples, but in the 18th century, the disputes abruptly ended when the area was conquered by China's Qing dynasty. Ever since then, Xinjiang has been a flashpoint for conflicts between the indigenous Uyghur people, who would like to make Xinjiang autonomous, and China's leaders, who refuse to release the area from what they call the Great Family of Chinese National Territory. Tensions worsened throughout the 90s and 2000s, and in 2014, China's new leader, Xi Jinping, cracked down. In a speech to officials of the Chinese Communist Party, or the CCP, he said, quote, "Show absolutely no mercy. We must subjugate the Uyghurs without any hesitation or wavering, using the organs of dictatorship." Xi's government quickly turned his terrifying orders from that secret speech into a public reality. By 2017, the Communist Party had filled Xinjiang with innumerable cameras, thousands of checkpoints, and hundreds of what they euphemistically called re-education centers. Xinjiang had been converted into a police state. By last year, somewhere between 1.1 million and 3 million Uyghurs were detained in these centers. That's of a population of only 10 million total Uyghurs. The CCP insists that the goal of these camps is to purge religious extremism from the Uyghurs' thinking and to teach them vocational skills. But evidence from survivors and from leaked CCP documents reveal the true purpose. The party is determined to Sinicize Xinjiang, to assimilate Uyghurs into a monolithic Han culture, and it is quick to eliminate any who will not submit to that goal. Detainees are forced to break their religion by eating pork and drinking alcohol. They are banned from praying or speaking their native languages. Resistors routinely face starvation, torture, sexual abuse, forced abortions, and sterilization. Unknown numbers are killed in the camps. Last year, Uyghur activist organizations testified to the China Tribunal that the CCP's crimes against humanity in Xinjiang included cutting out detainees' organs against their will. After reviewing testimony from more than 50 witnesses and mountains of video and written evidence, the tribunal determined, with what it called certainty and beyond reasonable doubt, that, quote, "In China, forced organ harvesting from prisoners of conscience has been practiced for a substantial period of time involving a very substantial number of victims." End quote. This is evil on a level that makes you physically sick to imagine. It's evil beyond words, and it actually conjures up associations for many with the Holocaust, when Nazi Germany slaughtered some 6 million Jews. In the aftermath of that genocide, a solemn vow was made by many in Europe and beyond. Never again, they said, never again would the world sit by as a government systematically carried out such satanic horrors on any group. This was a sacred pledge. But the Uyghur people are living a nightmare under the boot of the Chinese Communist Party. A 21st century Holocaust is happening to them right now. But just as with the Holocaust against the Jews in the 1930s and 40s, most Europeans are ignoring it, and very few of Europe's leaders are taking a meaningful stand against it. It is true that last year Germany signed a United Nations statement condemning the Xinjiang camps, but the words have been accompanied by no diplomatic punishments or economic sanctions, let alone military movements. Instead, as evidence of this modern Holocaust was multiplying, the EU decided to press ahead with a special trade summit with China. Katrin Kinzelbach is a human rights professor at the University of Erlangen-Nuremberg, and she said, quote, "The extent of human rights violations means it is inappropriate for Europe to court the Chinese party state in this situation." But that's exactly what Germany is doing with this special EU-China summit. So instead of never again, the modern Europeans are saying something like, genocide is okay as long as we can get richer from those who are committing it. The special trade summit between Europe and China was eventually postponed, but not because the EU finally developed a conscience about Xinjiang. It was postponed because of a different evil that China has unleashed on the world, COVID-19. And COVID is actually another example of evil by the Chinese Communist Party that Europe has largely ignored, pinning the blame on China for. China's state-run media has been trying to praise the Communist Party for the precious time that China bought for the world with its management of the coronavirus, but the facts show just the opposite. In the early days of the pandemic, which emerged in Wuhan, China, instead of taking steps to contain it and to warn the world, the Communist Party took exactly the opposite approach. They apprehended journalists reporting on the outbreak. They arrested citizens posting about it online. They detained doctors and strong-armed them into retracting warnings that they had previously issued. The Communist Party destroyed lab samples, refused to admit medical experts from other countries, and they lied repeatedly and brazenly to governments and media. And some Chinese critics of their handling of the outbreak were simply disappeared by the regime. The Chinese Communist Party tried to save face instead of save lives. It prioritized its own survival above that of the Chinese people or the other peoples of the world. And it is culpable for the virus's global spread. The facts show that it was the regime's dishonesty and ineptitude that unleashed this pathogen that has killed hundreds of thousands of people and has pushed economies into deep recession. And what has Europe's response to all this been? Back in April, a group of European officials wrote a report about all of China's guilt and ineptitude and disinformation with COVID-19, but then they decided not to publish it. The New York Times discussed this on April 24th, writing, quote, "Worried about the repercussions, European officials first delayed and then rewrote the report in ways that diluted the focus on China, a vital trading partner. Europe decided to take a very different approach than the confrontational stance adopted by the Trump administration in the United States." So there it is. Europe started to call China out for this evil that it had unleashed on the world, and for all the suffering caused by China's desire to save face. But then they seem to remember, wait a minute, this is a vital trade partner. We'd better rewrite this report and dilute the focus on China. And shamefully, that's what they did. It is true that about 2 months later, the European Commission offered some criticism of China's spread of false information regarding COVID-19, but just as with the Xinjiang situation, this equated to a token statement that has not reversed Europe's outreach to China one iota. And then there's also the situation with Hong Kong. Here again, China is committing terrible human rights abuses with a new set of security laws that the Chinese Communist Party imposed on Hong Kong this summer. With those laws, it shattered the promise it had made to the people of Hong Kong in 1997, saying that for 50 years they would have a high degree of autonomy. Hong Kong's autonomy is just a memory now, and China is trampling on the territory's democracy and freedom. And what was Europe's response to this? Other countries, such as the U.S. and Britain, quickly enacted laws to end extraditions to Hong Kong and to open paths for Hong Kongers to resettle in America and Britain. But the EU only announced that it would, quote, continue to follow developments. Robert Tyler, a journalist with New Europe, called this move akin to that of stating that you'll observe the future growth of a plant a month after you stopped watering it. It's not just with Xinjiang, COVID-19, and Hong Kong. China engages in all kinds of similarly illegal and disturbing behavior in Tibet, Taiwan, the South China Sea, the World Trade Organization, and in the economic, cyber, and technology realms. And with just about everything, the reaction from Europe is generally the same. They make statements or gestures that may not be wholly meaningless, but that are basically the bare minimum to give the appearance of caring about China's evil, and all the while keep on deepening the EU-China relationship. This behavior from Europe, a continent that professes to champion democracy and international law and human rights, it would be utterly baffling were it not for prophecies in the Bible that foretold this development. The prophet Isaiah wrote about this more than 2,500 years ago. In Isaiah 23, he discussed an immensely powerful multinational trade alliance that would develop in the modern age. And he tells us who the main players will be in this bloc. Tyre is one of them, and Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said this name signifies modern Europe. Another main player is Chittim. This is an ancient name for modern China. The scriptures show that Russia and Japan and other nations will also join this bloc. Together, these nations will come to control global trade for a brief time, and the details of these scriptures show that they will use that control to strangle America and some of its allies. Mr. Fleury writes about this in his book, Isaiah's End Time Vision. He writes, quote, "The Bible contains many prophecies of that European power attacking America. When it happens, there will be no help or sympathy from Asia. In fact, Russia, China, and Japan will form a brief alliance with Europe. All of them are going to besiege America, Britain, and the Jewish nation. This is why Isaiah's prophecy of an end-time trade bloc that includes both European and Asian powers is so intriguing, and why the trend of collusion between these two great economic blocs is worth watching." So it should be no surprise for us to see Europe forgetting about never again when it comes to China. We should actually expect the ties now growing between the EU and China, including those perpetuated by Europe's refusal to meaningfully confront China's viciousness, to only grow stronger. Even as China grows more aggressive and more malicious, Europe will increasingly side with it and against America.
Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. You did a good job of pointing to the prophecies, just showing the alignment between Europe and China, and how the fact that Europe is continuing to pursue this relationship and these ties with China, despite these human rights abuses, does align with that prophecy. It also just makes me think of the prophecy that our pastor general has been talking about quite a lot, where you have an alignment of several nations against the United States. And that mart of nations that you're describing is fundamentally an anti-American alliance. But it's this effort that you see taking place on several fronts, even within the United States and among other nations, to bring the superpower down. The fact that Europe's opprobrium is only reserved for the United States says a lot, when the fact that they're willing to turn a blind eye to all of these offenses by China.
Yeah, I think that's just rank hypocrisy and a double standard that's hard to conceive of when we see the Europeans sermonize to America endlessly about, how the president is cracking down on violent rioters in places like Seattle and Portland, or about certain immigration practices there with our southern border. But yet they're mostly silent about an actual genocide that's happening right now with a million people or more. It really is hard to fathom that kind of a double standard from Europe.
Mm. Well, we do appreciate that. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about Europe turning a blind eye to Chinese human rights abuses. He has an article in the October print edition of the Trumpet magazine. The name of that article, Whatever Happened to Never Again. You can find that at thetrumpet.com. Thank you, Jeremiah.
Thank you.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
With political division in America as fierce as it is, what will happen in the upcoming presidential election when the result causes about half of the electorate to think this spells the end of the country? Some people are bracing for post-election violence, as we will now hear in this report from Andrew Miller.
It is almost a foregone conclusion that there will be riots if Donald Trump is reelected as president of the United States. A coalition of progressive groups has been meeting to game out what happens if Joe Biden doesn't win by a landslide. On September 8th, the Daily Beast reported that a coalition dubbed the Democracy Defense Nerve Center met to pore over a report titled Preventing a Disrupted Presidential Election and Transition. But this report was not truly about making sure that elections are free and fair. The Democracy Defense Nerve Center held war games with John Podesta, the former chairman of Hillary Clinton's 2006 presidential campaign, playing Joe Biden. Three of the four scenarios enacted during these political war games ended in violence. The only scenario that ended peacefully was a landslide victory for Biden. Ironic for a report alleging that Mr. Trump is the one who wants to steal the election. But the fact that politicians like Podesta are putting these scenarios forward as realistic possibilities shows that the nation may be on the verge of a constitutional crisis and full-scale civil war. The first game described in Preventing a Disrupted Presidential Election and Transition predicts that there'll be no clear winner on election night. This either means a tie in the Electoral College or a Trump victory so slim that Biden refuses to concede until every last mail-in ballot is counted. Analysts have called this a red mirage scenario, where Republicans appear to win on November 3rd, but Democrats win after mail-in ballots are harvested. Since mail-in ballots are susceptible to fraud, the Transition Integrity Project predicts that Democrats may attempt to convince at least one Electoral College elector to switch his or her vote to Biden in such a scenario, leading to a Biden victory. But it also predicts that Vice President Mike Pence could choose to reject this faithless elector, leading to a scenario where both Donald Trump and Joe Biden claim to be president on Inauguration Day. The Democracy Defense Nerve Center predicts street riots in this nightmare scenario. The second war game predicts a clear Biden victory on election night. In this scenario, President Trump leaves office and there are no protests. But the third war game predicts a repeat of the 2016 presidential election, where Donald Trump wins the Electoral College but loses the popular vote. The Transition Integrity Project predicts widespread rioting in this scenario. It also predicts that the Biden campaign may be able to convince California, Oregon, and Washington to secede from the United States until Congress agrees to eliminate the Electoral College. But if Democrats retain control of the House of Representatives and Republicans retain control of the Senate, Congress's response to this crisis would likely be divided. The Democracy Defense Nerve Center predicts that this scenario will end the same way as Game One, with both Donald Trump and Joe Biden claiming to be the president of a country plagued by riots. The fourth war game predicts a Biden victory, but one where he narrowly wins with less than 51% of the popular vote. The Transition Integrity Project predicts that the Trump campaign may challenge the validity of mail-in ballots in this scenario, but Biden will organize protests across the country that will result in Republicans backing down and allowing him to take charge. Now, in more normal times, the idea of two people claiming to be president on Inauguration Day would seem like an apocalyptic fiction. But the nation was rocked by Not My President protest after Donald Trump won the 2016 presidential election, and political division in America has since deepened. A Rasmussen poll conducted on June 11th and June 14th indicated that 34% of registered U.S. voters believe that a civil war is likely within the next 5 years. This civil war may not unfold the way John Podesta predicts, but the Bible reveals that it actually will happen soon. The late Herbert W. Armstrong explained in his landmark book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that the Anglo-Saxon peoples who settled in the United States and Britain are the descendants of ancient Israel. This astonishing truth means that the Bible's end-time prophecies concerning Israel are primarily directed at the United States and Britain. This is key to understanding political violence in America. Some 2,500 years ago, God revealed an end-time prophecy to a Jewish slave named Ezekiel. In Ezekiel 3, it says, "Moreover, he said unto me, Son of man, eat what you find, eat this roll, and go speak to the house of Israel." So this prophecy is addressed to the house of Israel, but it was not delivered to Israel in Ezekiel's day, because 10 of the 12 tribes of Israel were already in captivity in Assyria, while Ezekiel was hundreds of miles away in Babylon. Yet God had Ezekiel write down his message to Israel, foretelling of a time when famine and war would devastate the cities of a rebellious nation. Ezekiel 12, verses 17 through 20 says, "Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, eat your bread with quaking, and drink thy water with trembling and with carefulness. And say unto the people of the land, Thus says the Lord God of the inhabitants of Jerusalem and of the land of Israel, They shall eat their bread with carefulness, and drink their water with astonishment, and their land may be desolate from all that is therein, because of the violence of them that dwell therein. And the cities that are inhabited shall be laid waste, and the land shall be desolate, and you shall know that I am the Lord." So this passage is describing cities being laid waste because of the violence of them that dwell therein. This is describing a civil war scenario that escalates into a foreign invasion. In Ezekiel 5, God reveals that 1/3 of the nation's population will die from pestilence, famine, and violence that result from this civil war. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry writes in his book, Ezekiel, the End-Time Prophet, "The pestilence or plague of violence will cause many health problems that will lead to famine. Sewage disposal will be disrupted, gas lines will be broken, jobs will be lost, society will unravel, and the collective panic will bring a stock market disaster. It will get so bad that violence and famine will take millions of lives." Now, such devastation never occurred in an Israelite nation from the time of Ezekiel until now. And so this is obviously an end-time prophecy about the United States. Now, how could such a dramatic prophecy like this be fulfilled? How could the most powerful and prosperous nation in human history fall to such a terrible fate? And one of the main reasons Americans are clashing with each other is over the issue of government control. By definition, socialism directly opposes limited government. The clash between these two ideologies is leading to a violent revolution. But the fundamental reason this is happening is not that President Trump is a fascist, as many leftists claim, nor is it because there are too few Republican voters. The reason is that the American people as a whole have turned away from God's law. And to learn why election violence is a harbinger of civil war, and to learn how God will restore America to greatness after its people finally turn to Him and repent, please request our free booklet, Great Again, by Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry.
Thank you very much, Andrew. So all of these scenarios, these post-election scenarios that this group put together, in their view, the only way that this election doesn't result in violence, if I understand this correctly, is if leftists get what they want.
Right. It was actually kind of ironic, because if you actually do read the full report, it's definitely written in a way that, like, Donald Trump's going to steal the election and we have to do what we can to protect democracy in America. But the people putting it together, it's like, well, it's John Podesta, who is Hillary Clinton's campaign manager the last election, and Bill Kristol, who is like a leader in the Never Trump movement. So it's all very anti-Trump people getting together to brainstorm a way to stop Donald Trump from stealing the election, and that definitely comes through in the rhetoric. But when you actually look at the outcomes, they're like, the only outcomes that end peacefully are, like you said, if they get what they want. If Biden wins, they're like, all right, then January 20th comes and Biden's the president, and there'll either be no riots or just enough riots to get the Republicans to back down. But they're like, but if Trump wins, then like we've got to convince California and Washington and Oregon to secede from the Union until in an attempt to like blackmail Congress into getting rid of the Electoral College.
Yeah. Yeah, the way that this is all shaped up over the course of Donald Trump's presidency, it seems the left has grown more and more angry and willing to use violence as a tool to get what they want. And you have several instances of prominent people on the left who are advocating open confrontation of people on the right and Trump supporters, even to the point where this last summer you had people actually killing Trump supporters. The fact is, it seems violence is very much a tool that the left is a lot more comfortable with than those on the right.
Right. You hear some of these politicians talk. I mean, they're predicting violence after the election, or even this report talking about violence after the election. But it does almost come across like a passive aggressive threat.
Right.
Where they're saying it's like, well, if the American people vote for Donald Trump, there's going to be anarchy. Now, it's phrased in a way that they're like, that there's going to be anarchy and it's going to be Donald Trump's fault because he's the one dividing the nation. Although if we step back and think about it for a minute, it's like, well, you're the one threatening to burn down cities if you don't get your way.
Yeah, this is just a few statements from the report. It says the concept of election night is no longer accurate and indeed is dangerous because the reality that this could very well be contested over quite a long time. And it says to mitigate the risks of that, we need to plan for a contested election, focus on readiness in the states, providing political support for a complete and accurate count. But they say address the two biggest threats head on, lies about voter fraud and escalating violence. And this is an interesting argument that Democrats make, that this, as this says, voting fraud is virtually non-existent, but Trump lies about it to create a narrative designed to politically mobilize his base and create the basis for contesting the results should he lose. So there is a plenty of evidence out there that shows that voter fraud is actually something that should be taken very seriously, but they're looking at the idea that there is voter fraud as being one of the most dangerous elements. Yeah, I mean, even Hillary Clinton has been talking about voter fraud from the last election.
Right. Yeah, and is that right? Because if you can actually, and the Democrats were much more confident last election. So you can definitely get the sound bites from Hillary Clinton and her campaign about like the peaceful transition of power is a hallmark of our democracy. And they're basically trying to like say that like, hey, if anyone claims that there was voter fraud in this election, they're wrong because they assumed that Clinton was going to win in a landslide and that Trump was going to contest it. And then when Trump won, they had to do some serious backpedaling, and now they're the ones alleging voter fraud. And so you're seeing coming into this election, they almost tip their hand that they're expecting to not do well on election night.
When you look at those prophecies that you described, and I think the one that you read from Ezekiel 12 is particularly strong, the fact that it is the people who live in the cities that cause, or because of the violence of all them that dwell therein, that you have this civil war event, really something that people should take very seriously. And you can see the factors at play here leading to the fulfillment of those prophecies very, very plainly. And we've already seen violence increasing in the cities. I actually wrote an article for the next Trumpet print edition, the November-December edition, called The Death and Rebirth of America's Cities, that talks about some of those prophecies, and it is something that we do need to be very vigilant for. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller, speaking about how this coming election could result in post-election violence. He wrote an article about this that you can find on thetrumpet.com. It's called Democrats Quietly Preparing for Post-Election Violence. Check it out there at the website. Thank you very much, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
When the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain made a peace deal with Israel, it meant casting aside the long-standing rule, no peace with the Jewish state until the Palestinians have a state. This has left the Palestinians feeling angered and abandoned, as we will now hear in this report from Mihailo Zekic.
On Tuesday, September 15th, the Abraham Accords were signed between Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain in Washington, D.C. This makes Bahrain and the UAE two of only four Arab countries in the world to recognize the legitimacy of the State of Israel. The other two are Egypt and Jordan. But what makes this unique is that Bahrain and the UAE are the first two to recognize Israel's legitimacy in over two decades. Also of note is that previously, Arab states have stated that their preconditions for recognizing Israel's legitimacy was for Israel to withdraw from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and recognize an independent Palestine. Both countries at this point has not made any demands as such. The closest thing to that was that the UAE stated that their precondition was that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu suspend his proposed annexation of parts of the West Bank, not cancel, but suspend. This means that Israel got the recognition of two Arab states for little to no concessions at all. Historically, many Arab countries have been extremely hostile when its members have expressed interest in recognizing Israel's legitimacy. However, lately, the Arab world has been taking a different turn to this. For example, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi tweeted his support of the Abraham Accords, stating that it would bring, quote, stability and peace in the Middle East, unquote. Egypt is one of the few Arab states that does recognize Israel's existence, but even Arab states that do not currently are expressing their support for the deal. For example, Oman's national broadcaster stated that, quote, the Sultanate welcomes the initiative taken by the sisterly kingdom of Bahrain, unquote. Even the Arab League, an international organization of Arab states based in Cairo, doesn't seem to be overtly hostile to the idea of its member states establishing relations with Israel. Earlier in September, a Palestinian delegation submitted a draft proposal to the League condemning the deal between Israel and the UAE, despite the fact that the majority of the Arab League's member states do not recognize Israel's legitimacy as a country. The proposal failed to get off the ground. The big prize for Israel would be Saudi Arabia. While currently Saudi Arabia has stated that it does not intend on following suit with Bahrain and the UAE, there are a number of signs that suggest that relations between Riyadh and Jerusalem are warming. Bahrain is a very close ally of Saudi Arabia, and many analysts state that Bahrain would have never established diplomatic relations with Israel without first consulting its Saudi friends. Mark Schneier, who has acted as an advisor to the Bahraini monarchy, has stated, quote, the Bahrain government has been very respectful of the Saudi position throughout this process, unquote. Saudi Arabia is the largest Arab economy, and it bailed out Bahrain during a financial crisis in 2018 and even sent troops there to quell an uprising against the monarchy in Bahrain during the 2011 Arab Spring. Another telling sign is that with the Abraham Accords, Saudi Arabia has given Israel permission for Israeli planes to use Saudi airspace from flights from between Israel and the Gulf Arab states. There are some Middle Eastern nations that are less positive about the agreement. Jordan and Turkey have both expressed skepticism, if not outright hostility, to the Abraham Accords. However, both already have diplomatic relations with Israel, and neither of them have indicated that they're planning on changing that due to the New Deal. The big losers in all of this are the Palestinians. Historically, they have counted on the support of the Arab states to pressure Israel to disengage from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and recognize an independent Palestine. However, between all of the Abraham Accords and the support that the various Arab countries have given to the Abraham Accords, this seems to be wavering, and the Palestinians are marginalized throughout all of this. After the Arab League rejected the Palestinians' proposal in September, Mohammed Ishtayeh, a Palestinian politician, said, quote, "The Arab League has become a symbol of the Arab inaction," unquote. West Bank Social Affairs Minister Ahmed Majdalani called the Abraham Accords, quote, "a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian people," unquote. So where would the Palestinians turn to while losing their normal allies? One answer is each other. The Abraham Accords seem to be one of the few things that can bring the rival political factions Fatah and Hamas together. On September 12th, various Palestinian factions, including both Fatah and Hamas, agreed on a unified field leadership for popular resistance in response to the agreement. Hamas Politburo member Hussam Badran said that the meeting was, quote, "a major step of progress," unquote. For years now, Palestinian leaders have been squabbling with each other almost more than with Israel. If they form a united front, this could change very quickly. Hamas is a terrorist group based primarily in the Gaza Strip and is considered among the more violent Palestinian factions, while Fatah, considered one among the more moderate but still quite hostile to Israel, has had a strong base in the West Bank. Hamas has been trying for a while now to gain its own base in the West Bank, and it hasn't been as successful as it would like. Fatah strongman Mahmoud Abbas, while not a friend to Israel, has been mostly successful in keeping Hamas out of Palestinian Authority politics. However, the Abraham Accords can bring the two groups together and perhaps give Hamas the entryway into the West Bank that it has been looking for a long time. The Trumpet has been watching the rise of Hamas in the West Bank for years. We wrote in August 2016, quote, "Given that the West Bank borders East Jerusalem, it is likely that the fall of half of the city is preceded by the West Bank coming under Palestinian control, especially that of the more violent Hamas faction." The fall of half of the city mentioned is in reference to a prophecy in the biblical book of Zechariah, chapter 14, verses 1 to 2. That reads, quote, "Behold, the day of the Lord cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee. For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half of the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city." We have pointed for a long time to half of the city going into captivity would be at the hands of the Palestinians. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury and managing editor Joel Hilliker wrote in the August 2008 issue of the Philadelphia Trumpet, quote, "The Arabs of the Fatah Party currently control the West Bank. However, Hamas terrorists and weapons are present throughout the West Bank, and there is little doubt that they are working toward getting control of this strategic region of Israel. Hamas's sponsor, Iran's, ultimate goal is to overrun Jerusalem. The West Bank adjoins this city." Previously, Palestinians have tried to gain control of East Jerusalem, which they see as their rightful capital, through negotiating with Israel. They have used the support of the Arab world, as well as other major international players on their side, to pressure Israel into giving up East Jerusalem. However, this support from the international community, including and especially from the Arab world, seems to be wavering now. And the Palestinians may feel that with the negotiations going nowhere, they may need to take matters into their own hands. And the prophecy in Zechariah 14 implies a violent takeover. Israel's normalization of relations with the Arab world may have been the impetus needed for the Palestinians to finally unite and begin planning such a takeover. Most wars between the Israelis and the Palestinians have been localized conflicts. However, the seizure of Jerusalem will unleash a domino effect of conflict that will engulf the entire world. To learn more about this, please request our free booklet, Jerusalem and Prophecy.
It's time for today's last word.
When he was young and first getting into business, the world was a big pie and he wanted it all. Herbert W. Armstrong wanted to make a difference in the world. He wanted to rub shoulders with highly influential people, leaders in business, industry, and politics. He wanted to live a life surrounded by quality things that only a lot of money could buy. And he was determined to make it happen. In his autobiography, he wrote, "In my foolish conceit of those days, I was cocksure that I was headed for outstanding success." He worked hard, and he did find outstanding material success, but it didn't last. God took it away from him. Not long after he was married, all of Mr. Armstrong's business ventures crumbled to pieces. He wrote, "The hand of God was taking away every activity on which my heart had been set, the business success before whose shrine I had worshipped. This zeal to become important in the business world had become an idol. God was destroying the idol." God is a jealous God. He tells us, "Seek first the kingdom." And as Mr. Armstrong said, anything else someone else seeks as more important than the kingdom of God is an idol. And when God wanted to use Mr. Armstrong, he violently smashed his idol. He'll do the same thing to you and me if we ever let anything come before him. Mr. Armstrong had been too set on material things, too much a respecter of persons. And as he learned, the more steeped in the thinking of the world we are, the harder it is to re-educate our minds in the ways of God. Mr. Armstrong, after having been really humbled by God's powerful hand, he decided to give himself over in service to God, to follow God unconditionally, to put obedience over personal desires and ambitions. He sacrificed everything for God's sake. And in many ways, that's where the real story begins. What happened in Mr. Armstrong's life at that point? Well, he had a change of heart. He wrote later of his youthful materialism, "Living without this former God was no longer painful once I gave it up. I'd found the true God instead. I found the overflowing joy of receiving new understanding of God's truth out of the Bible. I now plunged into the study of the Bible with an energetic zeal surpassing any efforts I had expended in the quest of material success. I found a new happiness and joy in the fellowship of those humble and lowly folk that was infinitely greater than any enjoyment experienced before. Mrs. Armstrong and I were now seeking first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. We learned that happiness does not consist of material acquisitions." Well, what was actually happening was God was changing the desires of Mr. Armstrong's heart. The presence of the Holy Spirit within him was dictating a new set of priorities and interests, aspirations and dreams. He wasn't interested anymore in winning the favor of influential men. His desire was to please God. He didn't want to place material wealth above all else. And he demonstrated through 28 years of poverty in service to God's work that he continued to seek first the kingdom. In giving Mr. Armstrong the abundant joy and happiness of his new life, God was actually fulfilling all the new desires of his heart. Now, is that the whole story? Actually, it's not. Remember, those youthful desires Mr. Armstrong had to make an impact, to associate with powerful men, to live a quality, regal life. Well, God remembered those things too. Mr. Armstrong made a big difference in the world. In spiritual terms, history will prove him to be the most influential man in modern times. Mr. Armstrong, in fulfilling the commission of Matthew 24, verse 14. He had the chance to travel the world over. He spoke directly with some of the most influential people on earth, leaders of nations, more important and influential, certainly, than anyone he would have been in contact with as an advertising man, in building the work of God. Mr. Armstrong established a standard of quality rivaling the best in the world. Just look at the exquisite construction of Ambassador Auditorium, of the colleges he founded. Quality with no expense spared. That was Mr. Armstrong's highest aim. And it was all with God's full support and blessing. Mr. Armstrong's heart had been turned to God, and God in turn made his life a virtual playground of excitement. God was able to use all of those talents and proclivities that Mr. Armstrong had once directed toward selfish ends. And now that he was truly seeking first the kingdom of God, God was able to fulfill the second part of that scripture, and all these things shall be added unto you. Think about it. What are the most ardent desires of your heart? Do you want them so much that you'd let them come between you and God? Or do you love God enough and patiently demonstrate proof of that love enough that, like Mr. Armstrong, you open the door for God to be able to bless you, even now in this short life, with the happy fulfillment of those desires? I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, and Mihailo Zekic. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Baltasar Gracian. First be master over yourself if you would be master over others. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.